You don't need to be a Sikh or even religious at all to feel the impact of that sequence. To truly savor rather than just merely consume is less a spiritual instruction for a specific tradition and more of a reminder of something most people already know but consistently forget. What is in front of us is enough. We just have to slow down long enough to taste it.
Hello and welcome back to Religion to Reality. I'm your host, Dave Plisky, and I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Father John Gribowicz. Religion to Reality is the podcast about living an integrated life. And for us Catholics, this season, it's all about listening to voices from outside our own faith tradition. We just finished up a couple episodes with Taoism, an episode with Confucianism, and now we're going to spend some time with Sikhism. Our guest, Nikki Singh, today is delightful and does a wonderful job of articulating the Sikh faith, starting with the total basics. So if you're unfamiliar with Sikhism, don't feel like you need to study up before you listen. She's got you covered. She's not just approachable, she's knowledgeable. So I think you'll enjoy hearing about it and find it interesting, if not very endearing. Today, we are joined by Nikki Singh, who is the Endowed Crawford Professor and Chair of Religious Studies at Colby College in the USA. She is an internationally renowned scholar of Sikh studies. Her latest books include Guru Nanak's Transcendent Aesthetics, Poems from the Sikh Sacred Tradition, Janam Sakhi, Paintings of Guru Nanak in Early Sikh Art, Poems from the Guru Granth Sahib, and The First Sikh, The Life and Legacy of Guru Nanak. Dr. Nikki has lectured worldwide and aired her views on television and radio. She serves on the editorial board of several journals. In recognition of her scholarship, Dr. Nikki has received numerous rewards. She was born in India and came to America to attend a girls' prep school. She received her BA in philosophy and religion from Wellesley College and her PhD from Temple University. Nikki, it's wonderful to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's a joy to be with you and Father John.
Yeah, likewise. So we often like to kind of begin the show just by hearing about you. We'd love to hear your story as much as you'd like to share of it, and particularly, how your spiritual journey, you know, played a role in your upbringing and today.
Well, here I am today. It's in Maine. My academic year just finished. The summer is beginning, but lots of work to catch up on. I was born in India and I grew up there and in Patiala, the town of Patiala. So this is, we are talking about the 60s. And my father had come to Harvard with my mom and I was attending a Catholic school in Patiala. It was a day school. And they got special permission from Rome to have a non-Christian stay at the convent there. So I was with the nuns, with the Reverend Mother. So I learned a lot about Christianity and so forth. And my dad was at Harvard, where at the Center for World Religions. So when he came back to Patiala, to India, there was a Center for Religious Studies that was established, and he was the chair of the first department of religion. As you know, India is a religiously rich country, lots of religions, but the academic study of religion really began in 1969 with this particular department of religion. And it was very interesting, Dave, because it was built like the form of a ship with different sails. So each sail represented a different faith. So there was Christianity, there was Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, there was Sikhism, Islam. And it was very interesting because in each of these units, they had cubicles for scholars, they had libraries, meditation rooms for each particular religion. And on top, they had light, flame, symbolizing that they were going to the same spot. So it was very interesting, and it was all water around it, fountains and so forth. So it was quite an intriguing architectural building. And that's what I was first kind of, you know, my first, experience of spirituality, so to say. And they would have scholars from all over the world coming there. And so I grew up in that very pluralistic tradition. But I must say, the teachers, my Catholic nuns, had a great impact on me. Because that's a school I attended from nursery through the ninth grade till I came to America. So those were very formative years of my life. And here I was a Sikh. I grew up in a Sikh home. I heard my Sikh prayers. I knew who I was. And yet it was the other. And we never saw it. It wasn't like I was being converted to anything, but it was just opening me up to a whole new world. And I think we cherished that. And so that's sort of my background. And then I came to high school here in America, to a girls' school in Virginia. And that's where I took a course on American Transcendentalists. And that's where I started. Who in the world am I? Till in India, we were very kind of, I grew up in the Punjab, which is primarily Sikh. We were quite, you know, confident of our identity, so forth, but only coming away. And in India also, keep in mind, Punjab, it was the British who had, you know, who the colonialists who were our rulers. And so English was the medium of language and so forth. So coming to Virginia, and I was the only foreigner there, it was a small school, about 100 girls. And to think, you know, reading that poem, Passage to India, who in the world am I? And I think it was longing for my language, longing for my family that really made me go into the Sikh world. Till then, I wouldn't have. And then I went to college and Wellesley was very supportive. The teachers were there. What I do now, I think I'm stuck in those years. I've been at Colby College. It's an undergrad college. I've been here for many, many years. Why? Because those 4 years at Wellesley were just so nurturing and it just opened up so much for me. That's where I took my first course in religions and I did my honors thesis, believe it or not, on the Guru Granth Sahib, Physics and Metaphysics of the Guru Granth Sahib. And that got published as a book. That was my first publication. So that kind of set the foundations. But I think it was coming with Walt Whitman's, you know, poem Passage to India, kind of who in the world am I? This is not me, you know, all this. I started longing for my religion, for my faith, for my language. And I went more and more into the tradition. So that's kind of the starting point.
That's a really beautiful story. Tell me a little bit more about the experience with the religious sisters, the nuns. You said that they were a big impact. Like, I'm really curious about that dynamic. What was impactful there?
They were just so kind and compassionate and was just something different. And I mean, I learned, you know, staying with them, our Father who art in heaven, you know, that was before anything because that's what we, you know, being in the convent. On the other hand, it wasn't like I wasn't forced into it with that image of how I could see the divine in my own way. So I could translate it. And also the hymns, you know, the Lord is my shepherd, nothing shall I fear. It just was something very, very, you know, poetic and attractive. And I also had my Sikh world. So it was just like these two were parallel. It wasn't like I was, you know, but I knew my Sikh world, but this was something curious about the other. I think that's what it was, you know, as a kid. And also we were primarily Sikhs and also Islam was a big part of the Punjab. But after 1947, the Muslims had to migrate. And so there was nothing. The only Muslim I knew was the dyer, you know, the persons who dye turbans, the Sikh scarves and so forth. And I would love to go into his little shop that was there and to see on Fridays his form of prayer. So I think it was maybe just a curiosity about, you know, how other faiths are practiced. So I had that. And India was just so plural. You know, my grandmother's place, we had no TV there, no electricity, but you would see processions. There are the Jain monks going. We talk about, you know, wearing masks now. I would see these people wearing all white masks, brooms in their hands and walking. And I remember asking my granny the first time, who are they? And those were the Jains for whom all life is very important and they don't want to breathe in any insects or germs lest they kill them. So it was kind of a religious education that you received everywhere in India.
Yeah. Speaking of education everywhere in India, I don't know if this is just me, but it seems like a high percentage of Indians who move to America have gone to Catholic school, that I mean, at least, have gone to Catholic schools. Are Catholic schools really common in India or what's going on there?
That's a good question. I think it's a legacy of the British. The missionaries were there, and somehow the other people started feeling, oh, for the girls, convent schools, and for the boys, it was these, private schools, the British schools, like Doon School, for example, is a very popular one in Dehradun and so forth. So public schools, what we call private here, the public schools in India that were started by the British. So I think this is kind of a colonial legacy. And to be honest with you, Dave, I do regret it because I never learned my own language. I didn't learn Sanskrit. It was only coming here that I would go back home every summer and then study my own mother tongue and Sanskrit, which at a later stage is much more difficult. I wish I had learned it earlier. So there were some pros and cons. We were kind of open to the other, but at the same time, there was a lot that was lost with our own in those schools.
So help us to understand Sikhism a bit better. I think probably a lot of listeners maybe don't have any experience with it and maybe are pretty unfamiliar. So could you give us just a basic overview of what the religion is all about, what your belief system looks like, how the practice is observed, and those types of things.
The Sikh religion, it's Sikh, that's the name, the term, and it was founded by Guru Nanak. He was born in 1469 in Punjab. You can well imagine 15th century India, how vibrant it was, how religiously rich it was, how pluralistic it was. So there were lots of Hindu schools of thought. There were the Jains, there were the Buddhists, and that's when Islam is entering into the country too. The Lodis have been there, the Sultans have been there, but Babur comes to India and establishes the Mughal Empire in 1526. So you have a whole lot of religions, and just think about it, when religions are kind of, when we feel insecure, Hinduism has always been there, Islam is coming. And people are feeling more and more insecure. And as they do, they become more and more fundamentalist, orthodox, and so forth. So Nanak is born in this period. And he has the vision of the infinite one, oneness. So, what is Sikhism in a nutshell? It's the word Sikh is really a disciple, a student, a seeker. So, you're always seeking. And Nanak was a seeker. He never gave answers. He had lots of questions. Who knows? And all the rigid systems that he inherited, that's what he kind of contradicted. And he brought religion to the person, to the emotional, to the individual, rather than following, these categories. And he told everybody, he traveled a great deal. So Nanak is somebody who has this angst, he has this spiritual longing, but he's in a culture where who were his peers? They were the yogis, they were the renunciates, whether these are Buddhists, Jains, and that was to find spirituality, people had to give up the world. They denounced their bodies, they had to conquer their bodies. So he was very much lost, he was spiritual, but this is the mode of spirituality. So he was There's a lot of angst there. And then he had this vision. He traveled a great deal. He met with people. He traveled. In those days, to travel by foot, going all the way to north, south, east, west, but that was the way to learn about the world, visit different places, religious places of worship. He met with so many people and interacted. So I think he was very much, wanting to know, wanting to learn. So that Sikh spirit, wanting, seeking out, and he had lots of conversations with people, dialogues, and more he discovered himself and his vision that there is only one reality. One. That is the quintessence of the Sikh religion. Ik Omkar, one being is. And I want to emphasize this one because, monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam that came to the country, but follow that one. But Nanak's one is different because this one is all inclusive. It does not exclude anybody. So this is something, and it's a numeral. And in that numeral, you can plug in anybody. You can plug in Yahweh, you can plug in Buddha, even though it may be Nirvana, emptiness. That too is a part of one. or Hindu gods, goddesses, it really doesn't matter because that is one. And I think that was his message. And with that message, he wanted to get rid of all the social hierarchies that we had, gender biases, religious biases, all these prejudices. I'm a Muslim, I'm a Hindu. And they say that the first words after his vision, after his mystical experience, he pronounces, there is no Hindu, there is no Muslim. And that's not to deny. I mean, this is Hinduism, India, one, pluralistic, polytheistic, however you want to say, and this monotheistic traditions coming together. And he says, these are just categories. Let's go beyond them and let's recognize our humanity. More important than anything is to be a good human. So, kind of those external categories, those rigid systematizations that people were so bogged down with, I think he wanted to get rid of that and really show the oneness. We are humans, and where can we find our transcendent realm? Where can we experience the oneness in everyday life? That was really his message.
No, it's really beautiful, and it reminds me of Saint Paul in the New Testament, where he's like, Gentile, Jew, woman, man, no more, all is one. That sense of oneness is very much at the very heart of, like, when we hear things of communion, like when we all are in a common union with each other. The thing you mentioned is interesting, is like, that I always find interesting, is like, we're all just called to be good people. And how do we become good? What would be the system of, like, we would say this would be like virtuous living in like, say, the Christian tradition. But like, what does that look like for a Sikh? How do they understand what the good life is and how they are meant to be good in the world?
I think essentially to recognize oneness, the divine one, because that's very important. When, as I said, our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Immediately you have that God out there, thou art in the heavens. And I think what he's doing is Nanak's philosophy, his ontological understanding is to bring that one into the everyday world. And for that, some of the institutions that he inaugurated, one Sangat to come together. Dave was just telling me that he's going to do some monthly where everybody comes together, kind of a, meeting. And that's exactly what Sangat is, to come together, a togetherness. So it was not to renounce the world. So what he's doing is he's bringing people who were kind of leaving the world. So Sikhism, marriage is important. You marry. It is in the everyday world, in the secular world, that you experience the sacred. So Sangat, being together with family, being together with your community, being together with the wider world, and recognizing your human responsibilities. So everyday work, everyday action is very important. So nothing is said, this is good and this is bad. So that's one. The other one is seva, which is selfless service. And I think the Buddha teaches it, wherever we are doing things for others, we are building ourselves up. The third would be kirtan, singing the praise of the divine, which we do with the hymns that, the Lord is my shepherd. Those kind of, when we praise, something happens. All these negativities that we have, they kind of dissolve, and we are, exalting the one, praising the divine. It does something to our psyches, to our consciousness. So kirtan, sangat, langar, it's a Persian word, which means really anchor, which is meals, cooking meals together, chopping vegetables, eating together. So if you ask any Sikh, what's a basic institution? Langar. Why would langar be so important? Eating, one, it is feeding the body. You can't think, you can't believe, you can't have faith unless you take care of yourself, of the body. But also, it's also breaking down those barriers. What is polluted? What is, pure? Because there were all these kinds of religious obligations. The Muslims won't eat this, and the Hindus won't eat it, and the Brahmins won't eat this. So all these food categories and who you sit with. all those were kind of denounced by Nanak. So everybody sits. So, and this is, keep in mind, this food is not charity. It's coming together and eating and savoring together. And for example, the Golden Temple, which is a very important sacred space for the Sikhs in Amritsar, 80,000 meals are served daily. And everybody's anytime, and even here in America, in Europe, wherever there are gurdwaras, go sit, cover your head, sit down, and you eat together. And there's no head of the table, no bottom of the table. Everybody sits in rows, so everybody's equal. So all that equality. So you're putting these things in practice. So to answer your question, to recognize the self and act in correspondence that there is only one reality. One of Nanak's verses that I very much like, Sarab jiyan mein aap pachane, recognize yourself in everybody else. Who do you see? You see yourself in that. So the other is a mirror for you. So you're not dualizing. So the basic problem in Sikhism, what Nanak Guru Nanak says, is ego. So when we are stuck in our egos, that's home man, me, I. That is the core of problems. That's the most toxic stuff, because then everything I do is for me. But when I let go of the ego, there's no dualism between me and the divine or me and the others. So that oneness and erasing the duality, dualism, I think that's kind of Nanak. So and everyday action is very important. There is no sin, by the way. We have this body, we have the five senses, and those senses are very important. That's something, which are ignored. And for Nanak, these are very important because these can be cultivated into virtues, satsantok, morality, truthfulness, compassion, patience, or these can degenerate into everything bad, greed, attachment, all that stuff. So these are the basics that we have, we human beings, and we can cultivate them through selfless service, through praise of the divine. These are various ways of refining our basic senses, and we can degenerate them too. And the core, the most toxic stuff is the ego, the haume, that kind of holds us and creates all these dualities and poisonous stuff. It's really toxic stuff.
How do you start to deconstruct the ego? Or, I mean, there's so many different ways that that's spoken of, like smashing the ego, like what does that look like? Like, how do you go about that practice?
By singing the praise of the divine one, oneness, really doing that. Doing selfless action, going, and I'm sitting in America here. I'm feeling that, okay, I'll go and do some volunteer stuff. I'll go to, volunteer myself, go work in the prison, work in a school, work at the pantry, food pantry, sh homeless shelter. So those are kind of the ways you can, build up or get rid of your ego rather than everything is for me. How can I make more money, or how can I sit and, do other things. So I think those are seva, selfless action, doing langar, listening to music, to praise of the divine one. These are some of the ways we can go about getting rid of our ego. But I think for me, sorry, but I'm more the poetry person. For me, poetry is very significant. Paying attention to poetry. I had for my annual, we have an annual lecture for my department. And this year I invited Professor Francis Clooney, who's a Jesuit priest. He's at Harvard, has been there for many years. And I just wanted to give him a topic. I said, I want you to speak about poetry, the function of poetry, because it does something to us, and it makes us be more attentive and so forth. So those are some of the ways we can build up our humanity and get rid of our individual ego, poisonous ego.
love what you're saying about trying not to label the world as this is sacred and this is profane, but recognizing, the divine in everything. And a lot of what you're saying seems to be focused on, the self and the individual improvement. But you did mention a sacred temple or a temple. And I know that there are places of worship for Sikhs. Can you tell us more about, kind of what worship looks like and what the community life is like?
Sure. The Sikh temple is called Guru Dwara, door to the Guru, door to enlightenment, Guru enlightenment, knowledge. So that's what it's called. So it's not a mandir, it's not a mosque, not Hindu. So Guru Dwara is the Sikh space. You go in. The first one, the kind of the iconic, the inaugural Gurdwara, had four doors, which were an architectural symbol that all four castes, because in India the caste system was very stagnant, it still is. And we have our own Wilkerson, who wrote that book on caste and its origins, in America. It's so important. Even Martin Luther King, when he was in India, he was called an untouchable. And he was like, oh, me an untouchable? And then he realized, yes, I am an untouchable. So that caste system was broken by the everybody is welcome at every stage. So and the center is the sacred text, which is all in brocades. It's the book. The book is the center. There's no image, no icon, no sculpture, no painting. It's the book, the holy book. And that's 1430 pages long. And it has the poetry, the verses, sacred sublime verses of the Sikh gurus. Not only of the Sikh gurus, but also of Muslim saints and Hindu saints, Bhagats and Sufis. Where would you find a text, a sacred text? And this is the most sacred entity for the Sikhs. Nothing more sacred than the Guru Granth Sahib. And it's opened every morning. It's considered to be the body of the gurus. And it's closed every evening. And the recitations from it are the form of Sikh worship all day. And this is poetry. Poetry to whom? Poetry to the Divine One. Everybody is in. So there's no, again, the text itself, the sacred text itself, dissolves those differences and segregations amongst religions. So, because we want the one.
And do you regularly go to Gurdwara, and are there clergy that are doing something, leading people?
Again, very, very important. There's supposed to be no priest, no rabbi in the, because the Guru Granth is the guru. That's
Okay.
the guru, and you are the, person interacting with it. So you don't need anybody. But yes, in Gurdwaras, you do have people, they're called Granthis, who the ones who read the Guru Granth Sahib. And so you have that. You also have people reciting. Kirtan is part of it, so you have musical instruments and so forth. So kind of drawing your attention where you're kind of singing the verses. Most of the book, it's very interesting, most of the book has been put into musical melodies, 1430 portfolio pages. Most of it is in the classical 31 raga system. So it is to be sung. So it's a very, very aesthetic mode. Worship, what is worship? Kind of raising your sensibilities. And I just want to mention that, we're talking about the dissolving of the sacred secular. It's the music itself is a way to build it up. And in Western philosophy, we have religion, we have ethics, and then at the bottom rung is aesthetics. And I think in the Sikh world, all those hierarchies are kind of, eliminated because the religious is the aesthetic. So when you're singing praise in the musical melody, something is happening to us, and that's raising of this, heightening of the senses. And again, that's why the importance of the body to me, which is sometimes we denounce and reject.
What is the evolution of the hymns, the scripture? Like, how far back does this go? Is it an open source or open canon? Do things get added to it, or like
No.
how does it evolve? Or
Yes, good question, Father John. It starts with Guru Nanak's hymns because he is the founder guru, and whatever was in tune with his message was incorporated into the text. And the canon, it was canonized in 1604 by the fifth guru. So there are 10 gurus in the Sikh tradition, starting with Guru Nanak. He wrote his poetry. It was passed on to his successor, Angad. He added so forth. And then the fifth is the one who canonized it. And that's what we have, the Guru Granth Sahib. Later on, the 10th guru's father, Guru Tegh Bahadur, the ninth guru's verses were added later. But that's nothing. This is it. And very interestingly, Guru Arjan, the fifth guru who created this text, he offered it as a metaphor, the metaphor of a platter. Platter with three dishes. Thal, platter with three dishes. Sat, santokh, vichar. Truth, santokh, contentment. Vichar, reflection. And these dishes are to be not just to be eaten, but savored. Jeko khave, jeko punche, tiska hui udharo. Liberation is attained not by mere eating, which is kind of very physiological and so forth, but savoring, punche. And that word, I feel in today's parlance, it's becoming very popular. Who is it? Laurie Santos at Yale. She teaches a course on happiness, and it's so very popular. And the basis of it is savoring. And this is something I've been emphasizing for many years, and to see that it's becoming very current and kind of taking on a new importance in contemporary times really makes me quite happy, because this is what Guru Arjan, 1604, this is how he offered the text to relish its, to savor its ingredients. And so that's, and the ingredients are what? Hindu, Muslim, Sikh, in any way. It's the poetry addressed to the Divine Mind. There are no narratives there. There's very barely any historical, inklings that we find in the Guru Granth Sahib. So it's just kind of a, things that are coming. It's kind of sacred poetry, kind of taking us. This is the way to answer your former question. How do you break that ego? By being in that mode where you praise the one, whether it's through music, whether it's through, reading the text. And it's very simple. So the worship itself, there's no particular hour. You can come and go anywhere. And a big part of it is having the meal, langar, where people are going, cooking, cleaning, whatever you want to do, cleaning dishes. It's all, everybody participates in it. Nobody is like, so you're participating in your own different way. And it's not charity. And then you eat together, sing together, eat together, be together. It's the whole emphasis is on togetherness. What could be more mundane than eating? But this is the most sacred. Each morsel, may I remember you with each morsel. That's what the gurus sing. And liberation, the fifth guru who canonized the text, what does he say? Hasandya, khelandya, penandya, khavandya, vichche hove mukt. Mukt, is liberation, ideal of Indic philosophies. Hasandya, while laughing, while dressing up, while playing, while eating, that's where we attain liberation. And wherever you're, another one, jahan tahan tahan bekunth, jahan kirtan tera, that's paradise where your praise is sung. So the divine one's praise, wherever we sing that praise, that becomes paradise. So the paradise is not beyond, it's right here, wherever we remember you, wherever we remember. So that sacred, secular, even the Gurdwara can be anywhere. Devi had asked me that question earlier. Wherever your praise is sung, that's where it is. So it doesn't have to be a formal space. And many of us, I don't have a Gurdwara near me. So, but I feel, I can practice it. I have the Sikh scripture and, reading from it. One of the daily kind of routines is when you open the text, and you just open it at random. And whatever that verse is on the left side, that's kind of your guiding principle of the day. And you may get the same thing at different times, you know, another month, another year, whatnot. But somehow or the other, it kind of intersects with my own issues, you know, whether anxiety, joy, etc., and that timeless. So there's always kind of the timeless and time interaction that's taking place in the Sikh world. It's here.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I mean, there's practices like that in Christianity. People are very much in connected with the scripture and just opening it up randomly and seeing what's speaking to them that day. You know, I'm really curious about the process of one becoming a Sikh. Is that such a thing? Like, for example, at the meal, is anyone welcome to be there, or is there some type of process to kind of understand, to orientate a person as to what is about to happen, or?
No, everybody's welcome. Just sit and eat. You know, we were in Dublin this summer, and I was going with some, you know, just on our own, my husband and I, and we ran into these students, and we go eat here every day, every Sunday. So no questions asked. Nobody, just all you have to do is sit on the floor. Everybody sits together and have your heads covered. And no shoes. You know, that's anybody. I used to do something over the summer at Montreal, at McGill. And so we were taking a group of students to the local Gurdwara in Montreal. And so there was a taxi driver, and I was giving him directions. I said, "The Gurdwara," Sutton said, "Oh, I go there all the time. I go and have langar there. It's vegetarian meal." So he knew more than I did where to go. And so nobody's asked. No.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's, I'm also thinking about here at the school where I teach, some of the teachers, we have like a mindfulness course, and we do mindful eating, and they take like a raisin and just like, you know, use the raisin and
Yes.
allowing that to, you know, recognize how much is happening in just such a small piece of food for the senses, you know.
Beautiful. That's it. I will use that. Yes, it's really important because we don't pay attention, and especially in our modern world, you know, so much happening, so many options and so forth. It's just creating such tensions amongst us. So just to take that time, you know. I have to read you. Can I read you my students? I taught this course on religions of India, and can I read you a little bit? And this is my
Yes,
student.
absolutely.
He's a Mason List. He's an economics major, and he may be a sophomore baseball player. I had a whole lot of baseball players in my class, and they were just so wonderful. I can't tell you, such great students. So this is. I just read it. You know, the grades were due on Tuesday. I was reading it then as I was going to Princeton. Reflecting on this course as a whole, I find it remarkable that a religious tradition so geographically and culturally distant from my life could offer something so immediately impactful to my well-being. I joined the class expecting to be an outsider, looking in, but now I can leave with a thought process for living that I fully intend to carry with me. I really enjoyed this class, and I'll make some very valuable lessons with me. More specifically, the fact that the cycle of Guru Nanak's teaching is one that anyone can enter. Knowing that savoring trains attention, and that attention reveals how much we have been given, and that recognition becomes gratitude on its own, is an incredible, valuable piece of knowledge to have as I progress on through life. You don't need to be a Sikh or even religious at all to feel the impact of that sequence. To truly savor rather than just merely consume is less a spiritual instruction for a specific tradition and more of a reminder of something most people already know but consistently forget. What is in front of us is enough. We just have to slow down long enough to taste it. Just as you were saying, Father John, about the raisin in one raisin, you know. So I thought this was my student. I was really, really happy. And so many of them, I had 33 students, and most of them had responses which they will take on. It's not religion, is not to become a Sikh or anything, not at all, but to get something out that we can use. I don't know. I just feel I'm a utilitarian. I want to make use of things, make use of poetry, make use of knowledge. And
Yeah, absolutely. I mean that comment's beautiful. I'm gonna steal all that for a homily. So there you
by the way, the raisin meditation that you mentioned, I recently listened to an audiobook by Jon Kabat-Zinn, super short, it's like 2 hours. It's called Mindfulness for Beginners. I think it's a book also, but I think that the audiobook makes more sense for this case, because he actually, the second half of the book is he leads you through a few meditations, mindfulness meditations, one of which is the raisin one. So if you want a very good guide to do it for you, I can't recommend that enough. And that's cool. So Nikki, the one of the most visible aspect you in passing much earlier mentioned the turban, and I feel like that's one of the most visible kind of distinct things that you might see where you it would say, oh, that's probably a Sikh. Tell us more about the turban, and are there other things that we might look out for but I just want to know what the meaning is and more
Yeah,
about that.
and that goes back to Father John's earlier question, Sikh, what is a Sikh identity? So Guru Nanak is the founder who gave us this notion of oneness, gave us these institutions of, togetherness, sangat and langar, seva, etc. Fifth guru gave the book, space. Gurdwara, the golden temple where everybody can come together. That was a consolidation of identity, getting a sacred space, having a sacred text. The 10th guru, Guru Gobind Singh, he's the last of the 10 gurus. He's the one who gave that physical identity format. How can a Sikh be recognized? And there were the 5 Ks that he gave, and long hair, kesha, steel bracelet, kara, kirpan, a salt sword, kachcha, long underpants, kanga, for the comb, for the hair, long hair. Now, these are 5 very simple items of faith, Sikh faith. So the turban is to kind of cover your head as so it was not to be because the ascetics had long hair. Remember all the yogis and so forth, the dreadlocks of modern times. So people had long hair. But this was not to be that. You're a part of society. You have to be a civilized person. So that's why long hair and the comb, to comb your hair, to kind of be a part of our civilization, to be a part of a member of society. And so turban is kind of covering your head, covering your hair. So that's what it's. So uncut hair, so you don't have men cutting their beards or women. We are bare. I don't have short hair, bobbed hair, or anything, braid or whatever. And then this, the kara, everybody may. And these are for both men and women. These are not just for the men. So these are both for men and women. And the kara is all action is good because the actions, your status and so forth, dependent on, what your what where you were born, whose family you were born in, caste is all caste, class, your professions, all dependent on your biology. And the fifth guru erased all that. He gave those 5 people to drink nectar from the same bowl, so to spit out all kind of differentiations. So the kara kind of a symbol that you remember the one all the time, and every action is sacred. So there's nothing, no act which is bad. Of course, immoral acts. You can't do that because you're keeping the one in mind. Same thing, the underpants, to have respect for your body because the Jain monks and so forth walked around, they had conquered their bodies and they would walk around nude. And Guru Nanak was not for that. You have to be take care of yourself and respect your bodies and respect the other bodies of others. So that's a sign. And the sword became a symbol because, as I was saying earlier, the Mughals were rulers and Aurangzeb, there are certain rulers like Akbar who were very pluralistic and very nice and, open to the Sikh tradition. But then one of the ones towards the end who was during Guru Gobind Singh's period, was somebody who wanted to make India into an Islamic country. And so the Muslims were given priority, and all the others could not carry weapons and so forth. And so Guru Gobind Singh wanted people to be strong and courageous and fight against injustice. And sword became a symbol that everybody should be able to free to carry the sword. And did we forget anything? Such a long
Okay, but
name.
are people's, I mean, are, I obviously, you're not wearing a turban. Well, maybe it's not obvious to our listeners,
No, but it's not
but
necessary. I don't think it's necessary.
yeah.
Long hair is the necessity. It doesn't
Okay.
say a turban is not the
Oh, I
necessity.
see, I see. But you don't carry around a sword, right?
But you can have it in a symbol. Sometimes I have a little necklace. It's
Okay.
symbolic, you know?
Okay. Yeah, I like
Like my
that.
dad had it in his comb, a tiny little thing that was in his comb, you know? So it's more,
Cool.
so it doesn't necessarily have, these are symbols. And
Right.
that's what I have a book that I did, Remembering the Birth of the Khalsa, because it seems very patriarchal. And I wanted to do it from a feminist perspective. And to me, these five items of faith are all in the Guru Granth, in Sikh scripture, and in Nanak's poetry. And they are kind of given a materialistic, physical, corporeal aspect by the 10th guru. But they're all there, and we can find it. And he made it into, you know, and it's also the sword of compassion, sword of wisdom. You know, that's what the woman carries to fight out all her inequities and injustice and so forth. We find that, I think there was some image of, when I was doing some research, even of the Virgin Mary, some artwork where she has a sword in her hand. So to me, it's more, I wanted to show them rather than as signs. These are symbols which have a much larger meaning to them. They have much more humane dimension to them rather than these very artificial external signs. And sometimes, I'm sometimes upset with my own community when we make them into mere signs and not see what's behind them. So to me, it's really important to see the message of the gurus, the message of the scripture, and read that into what we wear, because that's where we get more strength and more power of these symbols.
John, you're going to take us into sacramentalism?
Yeah, I mean, I'm reading a book right now called Sign and Symbol right now. So I mean, yeah, I mean that's so interesting because symbol is very important within the Catholic world. I mean, the Christian world. I mean, especially in the sense that a symbol is a reality too. It's not simply just like you said, a sign that's pointing you to something. It's an embodied reality, which elevates the importance of it because it's revealing something about the truth of existence, the truth of life, the truth of relationality, whatever you want to kind of say that it is. So I think that's a really fascinating concept to just kind of sit with. Like we often just kind of conflate those two words as being the same thing, a sign and a symbol. But like a symbol is really like embodying a reality.
Exactly. It's an existential. It's something that we live. It's not just at an abstract and, you know, or just a mere, this means this, you know, it's more, there's a subjectivity to it. There's a feeling to it. There's an affect to it. You know, the flag symbolizes something, you know, whereas.
That's really powerful. It's something I want to chew on a little bit more in the way that you described it too. So it's beautiful.
Nikki, before we started recording, you were telling me about how there were these verses right at the beginning of the Guru Granth Sahib that are all about listening, and we always close out our conversations about listening. So, can you tell me a little bit about that?
For Guru Nanak, three things are very important. Suniye, maniye, man ki tapao. Suniye, listening. Listening is really important. This means we are giving the other importance and we are really putting ourselves below them. It's somehow understanding, literally standing below. Let them speak. Usually it's our ego. Even before we listen to somebody, I'm ready to say something. So listening is really, really important. So there are four verses in the Japji on listening. And then the next thing comes, maniye, maniye. So you listen and then you take it to the second level, which is really kind of imbibing it, embracing it. I've started translating it as embracing. And then man ki tapao, to nurture love. Love is the essence, quintessence of Nanak's philosophy, Sikh philosophy. Guru Gobind Singh to jin prem kiyo tin hi prabh payo. Only those who have love find the divine one. This is what we find in Sufism. We find in Buddhism, even Lord Buddha, to have the love that a mother has for her child. Love, the sermon, Jesus' sermon on the mountain. Love, love, love is so important in all religions. And that's something, Dave, we have forgotten. We don't have the capacity to love. And that is love because we are so centered on ourselves. How can we nurture that? So listening and then embracing what we listen to, that's very important. And that leads to kind of love. And love is just not at a romantic level. It's just really fighting for injustice. What Martin Luther King, injustice anywhere is everywhere, so to say. So we have to, the world is at a very, we're leading a tough, we're going through some tough times. And it's important to inculcate those, and love really, and I want to say that my latest book was really on philia, love. Love for what? Love for the theos, for the divine. That's very important. And the divine is, once you recognize that one is everywhere, one is infinite, one is within you and me, you have a different attitude. So love for the divine, love for the body, somatophilia. And that's my big thing. We are very, our culture is very somatophobic. And oh, I can't eat this, I can't do this, I can't, we just create so many rules and regulations. And something that takes us away from our bodies, unless we love ourselves, we cannot love anybody else. So to have love for our body, because these are the senses that we have, and to inculcate them and refine them, hone them. So theophilia, somatophilia, love for the body, anthropophilia, love for human beings. We cannot exist in isolation. And that's where where listening comes in, helping others out comes in, being with others comes in. So all those are very, very significant. And then biophilia, this world is sheer magic. Let's take a walk out. Just what we see. We are just, most of the time, it's just that we have become so inundated. To me, aesthetics, as I was saying, is very important, because the opposite of aesthetics is anesthetic. You take some anesthesia, you don't feel a thing. And I think that's what our culture has become. How to heighten ourselves, how to feel things, savoring, as you said, looking at the raisin, that meditation, Father John, you were talking about. It's through our senses. What am I seeing? What am I feeling? And this world is beautiful. We are made to look too much out there, out beyond, into the heavens, and we miss out all here. So Nanak says, instead of death and so forth, look at where we are born from. Who's our mother? What's the womb that we came from? And he has beautiful scenarios in the mother's body where the divine is. The divine has the hand on the fetus. Those are beautiful images and something that humans forget. So to me, that recognition, to feel the magic in this world out there, we take for granted these stars. If we saw them once in a blue moon, we would be so excited, but we have become so, it's all there, never feeling, never seeing things. So to smell and see and feel and taste that one everywhere. That's religion. So it's not somewhere else. It's not going to the Gurdwara. It's here and now. So, but anyway, there are four. Get my translation. I've been translating six scriptures. So Harvard University published my translations. HarperCollins did years before. So I do a lot of translations, because the translations kind of ruin the original. The original is very simple and beautiful. He did, Guru Nanak, all the gurus did not speak in elite languages of Sanskrit or Persian or anything. It was the everyday vernacular, and that's what it's there. And so to have that, to get that feel for that language, it's important to read the original and translate. So instead of thous and these that, you know, that translators kind of interject, you know,
Yeah,
love.
well, I love that it all leads to love. But going back to the idea of listening, how do you cultivate a posture of listening so that you can embrace it and then eventually live that posture of love? How
I think
as a Sikh are you do you become a good listener?
practicing it at the everyday level. I see somebody, hello, how are you? Off I go. Do I listen? So to be there, yes, how, you know, how are you? You know, to really hear them, just at that very basic level, Dave, which we don't do. We ask, it's so common, hi, how are you? Off we go. Do we pay any attention to the other? I think listening is what Nanak says, you know, recognize yourself in the other. Do I see this person? Are they in pain? Are they happy? What's going on? To kind of connect with them. It's a relationality. It's an intersection of the me and the other coming together. That's what listening is all about. And it
And
requires patience. It requires patience. We don't have patience today. Too many things to do. I have to do this. You know, every second is taken up. So I think it's patience, attentiveness. It's just simple things. We don't have to, you know, listening is, I'm listening to you. What, you know, those are, we start right here, not at a later time.
Yeah.
In the
Well,
simple things.
I'm imagining, once upon a time when I was looking at undergrad schools, I looked at Colby College.
Oh
And
my
so
God, Dave.
I'm just imagining what my life might have been like if I had taken a religion class with Nicky Singh instead of
No, that's the only thing that went against you today, not accepting Colby. It's a lovely college. I really love my students. They're just so adorable. Really, I cannot tell you. And this is my perfect integration, you know? What do I want? What do I love doing? Going into my class and seeing them. And then I want to come back, sit at my study, and write. Write what? About Sikh scripture, about poetry. So it's, my world is so, you know, all so
Integrated.
integrated.
That's
Totally.
right.
Total synchronicity between the my professional life, my personal life. And I'm really glad, and to meet people like you and Father John and so forth. I just feel so honored. And when I go, there aren't too many Sikhs in this, you know, in Maine. Very few. But I go to California, I go to New York, anywhere. It's just such lovely people, and everybody accepts me. And I think that's what, you know, although I came very early in life, I was only 14 when I came to America, I kept my identity because people were so good to me, both at home in America, and my teachers, they gave such confidence. My students, you know, that, so your identity is reinforced how you're seen by others. And they really reinforced me, and they validate me, and I didn't have to be anything else than who I am. So it just gets more and more reinforced. So thank you, and I'm really grateful. Great meeting you, Father John.
Yeah,
Great
so
seeing you
beautiful.
today. So I really am very honored to be with you both.
Oh no,
Yes.
we've been very pleased to meet you and to hear from you, and this has been great. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Bye.
All right.
Nikki Singh, what a helpful and clear articulation of the Sikh tradition. I'm still thinking about her comment about signs and symbols. The beauty of how we understand the sacraments in the Catholic faith is that they are both signs and symbols, and not only that, but that they affect what they signify. I think that's the same type of thing that Nikki was getting at as well, and it's what Father Michael Himes discusses in his book, The Mystery of Faith, whose subtitle is something like An Introduction to Christianity, but it actually makes a number of very deep points. And the one on the sacraments that he makes is that because everything comes from God, everything really is a sacrament because everything points beyond itself to God, if only we have the eyes to see and the attention to notice. Well, we're on the home stretch of the podcast. I think there are only 5 episodes left. Join us next time for our last session with people of non-Christian traditions. We started in Christianity with a Catholic, a Protestant, and an Orthodox, and we'll end the season with Christianity as well. But before we get there, we're going to spend an episode with some Shinto priests, Taishi Kato and Anne Evans. Also, I have to say that I love the fact that Nikki mentioned the monthly interfaith gathering, since that's what I'm about to do now. Yeah, I know you might be binging this and you're like, Dave, I've heard this so many times. I know you have a monthly gathering. Well, my question to you is, why haven't you signed up yet? Head on over to our Substack, religiontoreality.substack.com, and check it out. You can find the registration link there, and we'd love to see you on the first Wednesday of the month for an hour meditation and discussion on some topic. You know, it'll change every month. First Wednesday, Substack, Religion to Reality. Find it. We'd love to see you there. Religion to Reality was created and is executive produced by me, Dave Plisky, and is produced and edited by Nick Strapoli and Connor Donnelly. You can find the show notes and other resources at religiontoreality.org. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.